Accession number 13426, Harold van der Wolf, Reel 2.
Mr. Harold van der Wolf, Reel 2. We were talking about your training with the recruits platoon of 1st Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry at Rookley on the Isle of Wight. We've talked about bayonet work. You mentioned fire drill. What was that?
Well, we used to go to a target practice area. We first of all, went on 202s, you know, smaller weapon, and then went on to the 303, the Enfield rifle. The 202 was to get us to get our marksmanship right, you know, on the target.
This was extra to what you'd done in the 6 weeks?
Oh, yes, different altogether.
Working up.
That's right. And then we went on to moving targets and that sort of thing. Enjoyed that. I did enjoy learning the fire rifle and Bren gun, and I think the Piat was a bit more difficult because...
Tell me about the Piat, because we haven't covered that
yet. Well, a Piat gun, the best way to describe it is to say that it's something like a drain pipe with a huge spring on it, and to load it you have to stand on it and pull it up, and it fires... in a bullet, it's, you know, these children's tops that you strike up and down and they whirl around and make a noise, something like that with a long spindle, and you could virtually see it leave the weapon, and of course you had to be very close to a tank to do any damage.
About what range would it have then?
Oh, about 15 yards, I suppose.
15?
Mm.
That's very close.
Oh, yeah.
Did you practice firing them?
Oh, yes, and... And you see, the big thing about the Piat is you must know anything behind your feet for a considerable distance because of the kick. It gave you a thump and sent you flying backwards. You know, it was a hefty weapon. I mean, if you had something behind your legs, you'd break your legs. You know, in other words, you wouldn't lie down with a wall behind you, close to your feet, because the kick of the thing would send you back and break your legs, probably. That quite a hefty, it hurt your shoulder, there's no doubt about that. A lot of blokes never went on training it, they didn't like it, and they weren't made to.
Oh, it was optional?
Mm. Mm.
And how accurate was it in training?
Well, you had dummy tanks, and you had to try to get the petrol tank, if you could, which was situated in various parts according to the tank you were firing at. And, if you were within 15 yards, it was very accurate. You could blow up a tank, all right.
It was a matter of getting within 15 yards.
Well, and also picking out the right tank and the right position of its weakest point, really.
So it was an effective but difficult weapon.
Oh, yeah, and difficult to carry. And, of course, once you fired at a tank... There was no question of standing up in the field and loading it again, you know, because the enemy would see you. So it was limited to one shot at a time, and then you had to disappear and get behind cover and to load it again.
So that, and would they practice that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What other weapons were you introduced to during this 10 weeks?
Well, I was on a pistol for a while, but I was never very successful with a pistol. I could never get used to the kick. So I became a marksman with a rifle, I became a marksman with a Bren gun, and I became a marksman with the Piat, but I could get nowhere with a pistol. I very rarely hit the target. It was one of these weapons that I just... But unless you were an officer anyway, you didn't carry a pistol.
Any other weapons?
No, that was the only weapon.
Not the mortars, then? 2-inch mortars.
Oh, sorry, yes, of course we went on to mortars. But I didn't do a lot of mortar work because at this stage they were considering as to what speciality you might go into. And it was recognised in the Dukes, really, that before you could specialise, you had to be a good rifleman. And therefore, they expected you to be a marksman at least with two weapons. Because quite often, a chap would try and specialise either in MT or signals or something to get out of being in a rifle company. You know. So the Dukes were very good. They made sure that you were a good rifleman.
So you'd got your three specialities. So mortars, you weren't pushed into that much.
No. Learned to fire them. But
one thing we forgot, or I've forgotten, not you, is hand grenades.
Thrown a hand grenade. Yeah, I'd forgotten that. But, oh yes, we used to go into special bunkers to throw hand grenades. First of all, dummy ones, and then live ones.
Did you find them? They used a cricket action, didn't they?
You pull out the pin and you fling your right arm back behind you, and then you bowled it over like that. You didn't throw it. You bowled it.
Can you explain why not? Why didn't you throw it?
Well, because it was supposed to be more accurate. You'd put your left hand out and line it up with a target, and then bring your hand over, and it was supposed, I think it was alleged that it was much more accurate than throwing.
It was a genuine bowling action then?
Yes, yeah.
And you played cricket, I don't know, you said you were a wicketkeeper batsman, but were you accurate?
No problem with a grenade at all.
About how far, because they're heavy, how far could you get it, roughly?
Well, a fair distance, I mean, I would like to say the distance, but you could get it a fair distance, yeah. Yeah. Well, you had to, because else you'd get the repercussions from the... Because, I mean, a grenade would split up into fragments and fly all over the place.
Now, other aspects of training. How about tactical training, advances, you know, battle drill, that sort of thing? Did you do any of that?
Yes.
Before we go on to your speciality...
We you were taught how to crawl and how to get out of trenches, you know, and... ditches and things like that without showing yourself too much. In other words, you would come up of a ditch and go over flat, not stand up in a ditch and jump out. You would crawl out so as to show very little of yourself.
To keep low.
That's right. And also holding your weapon to crawl. You used to hold it across your arms and wriggle yourself across the floor. Yeah.
What about the actual attack formations, battle drill, you know, covering fire, this sort of thing? Did you actually go into that?
Not a lot of that, no. No. No.
And what about digging slit trenches?
Well, you had your trench, your entrenching tool. And, you know, you just dug a hole big enough to get yourself into. We were taught how to do that. And on our route marches, we were taught how to cook. You know, we'd go on 25, 26 mile route marches and have to cook your own meal at lunchtime. I was fairly fortunate because I had two uncles in the cookhouse, actually, and we used to have to go there and get our on-cook rations. You know, that would be a bit of meat and a potato and carrots and that. And when I went to collect mine was always cooked. And they used to, my uncles used to say, now look, you know, when it comes to cooking your meal, don't do it too quick, you know, because they'll spot that you've cooked. But I always had mine pre-cooked. I was very lucky, really.
So you were just warming up. What would you use to cook?
Well, dig a trench and use dry fire and tinder and stuff like that. And then you were taught to use petrol in mud, in earth. In the desert, they used to put it in the sand, but we were told how to use it in the road. Because you don't get the smoke from that, so that you wouldn't give your position away so much.
Anything else you were taught during your time with the recruit platoon? Or are you now on to your specialisation?
Yeah, I then went on to specialisation.
Did you have any choice?
Yes, you were. Well, you were asked what specialisation you would like to go on into.
Did everyone go into one?
Oh, no. No, a lot didn't want to because of the extra mental activity that it incurred, you know. But I went into the signal platoon.
What attracted you to that?
Oh, my father was a signaller in the First World War. And
had he taught you Morse or anything?
He had started to teach me Morse, and I didn't want to learn. Now, he used to have my other two brothers, on the end of the table and teach them Morse. And I think I was the only one that ever used it, and I didn't take advantage of being taught. I had to learn. I was silly, really, I didn't think, when he was teaching them, I wasn't interested in Morse.
He didn't think you'd have a use for it?
That's right.
So how did they go about teaching you signals? Because what did they start with?
Well, when you train to be a signaller, you have to learn the procedure for using WT, which is speaking over a radio, RT, which is sending Morse over a radio. You had to learn your Morse code, you had to learn your semaphore, you had to learn signalling with lamps. And you were taken through all this in stages. Now,
what was the procedure on the wireless for speaking over it? What do you mean by procedure?
Well, the idea of the procedure was that you should all use the same phonetics and the same code signals and the same call signs and things like that, so that in action you change your frequency every day. Now, the idea is that if somebody had a particular way of saying things that was not in the book, it was considered that the enemy would say today, oh, no, that chap was on such and such a frequency yesterday. And they would probably get the unit by that sort of thing. So it was very important that you knew your procedure. You had procedures for calling up all stations. You had procedures for calling up a particular station. You had procedures if you couldn't reach a station and another station could hear them, you could go through a third party. Now, I was always known as Procedure King Harry, because they always used to call me Harry in the Army. And
why was that?
Well, I had a thing about the procedure book. I seemed to learn it off by heart. And I was very often used by the instructor to tell the others what the procedure was.
That was just part of your keenness, then?
That's right. Oh, yes, I threw myself into it. Funny enough, never took my final examination, because when we were coming up, because it was a 16-week course, and when we were coming up for our exam, to be a qualified signaller, to entitle you to wear the flag, the cross flag, we were transferred to the Durham Light Infantry.
I'll come back to that. So there was oral procedure on, you know, when you were broadcast WT. Mm-hmm. Now, RT, was that as important by then, sending Morse?
Well, it was important in our training, because it was considered that it would be used greatly. In fact, in Normandy, we didn't use it at all.
So you had to learn more. So, but in fact, it's a bit of a waste of time.
Well, it turned out to be a waste of time. Same as semaphore. You know, we learned semaphore. And never used it, you see.
Were they difficult to learn for you? I mean, some people have a knack for Morse and semaphore.
Yeah, I had no problem with Morse. And in fact, I can send Morse now. I don't know if I could receive it very well, because receiving it is all a matter of hearing sounds. Because the knack in sending Morse is that you must send at the speed that you can receive, because there's no way that the chap on the other end can know what speed you can receive. So you send the speed that you can receive, because it's so much easier to send Morse than to receive it. So you were in danger of sending faster than you could receive. But the chap at the other end could say, oh, well, this chap's quite fast, I can send now a bit faster. And you'd then find that you couldn't receive.
So if you got a real sort of regular trained signaller who'd been doing it for years, he'd send it too fast for you.
Yeah. The sort of accepted speed in the light infantry was about 15 words a minute. So it wasn't all that fast. As an instructor, you were expected to send about 30, I suppose. Because I became an instructor eventually.
But not before you joined?
Not until after I came back from Normandy.
So you made good progress on that, but you didn't do the course. You were doing this course until you got sent to the Durhams. Now, before we come to that, how do you think this experiment of attaching you to the regulars, or the 6th Battalion, the 1st Battalion, how do you think it had worked as compared to the other system?
Well, we enjoyed it because you were out of barrack life. I mean, we were lucky we were in a big private house. Completely different sort of existence to barrack life.
What was better about it?
Well, there was more freedom. You had fewer people to a room sleeping. Also, there was a great comradeship between the 40 of us. Instead of being one of, say, 100, 150, 200 people, you were just one of 40. And we all became pally and that sort of thing.
How were you treated by the other men from the battalion? The rest.
Didn't see a lot of them. Didn't see a lot of them.
You were segregated off then.
That's right. We did become known as Major Norley's little boys. That was the sort of expression that was used. I know I was at a transit. We were at a transit camp at Southampton. Running this transit camp, and those of us that were on the staff of the transit camp had to use one mess room, and the people that were coming through the transport, they were Canadians and all that sort of thing, they used another cookhouse. Well, we had certain jobs to do, and there were four of us who found that we were in such a long queue to go into our own mess room that we wouldn't get our job done. So we dashed in and used the other mess room. And the sergeant, this particular sergeant, he wasn't a very nice bloke, really. He caught us, and he put us on a charge, and we were brought up in front of our major. And I remember the major asked why we had used this mess room. And I always seemed to finish up being the bloomin' spokesman. And I said, well, we had a certain task to do, and we had to do it by a certain time. And there was no way we were going to get a meal because of the queue in the mess room. And we got let off. And this sergeant said then that it was because we were Major Northey's, we were Major Northey's little boys. And a few weeks afterwards, that sergeant and a few others, and some from our recruit platoon, were transferred to Italy. And I know we all cheered the sergeant off, We were glad to see him go. But we were sorry to lose some of our mates, from the 40 of us that went to Italy.
Now, you were running a transit camp, so you did have some duties as well.
Oh, yes, yes.
But yeah. That was the main one, the transit. What did it entail, the transit camp?
Well, I was I was on cookhouse duties, which meant that just scrubbing all the cookhouse stuff and peeling the spuds and all that sort of thing.
And how long were you doing that for? Just
several weeks, several months, perhaps. Yeah.
So as well as the training, you were on that as well?
That's right, that's right. Because I lost a bit of training because I developed appendicitis when I was at Rookley and was taken into hospital at Newport, Parker's military hospital, and had my appendix out. So I had 4 to 5 weeks in hospital, because in those days an appendectomy was quite a thing, and you were kept in bed for quite a long time. Now you get out of bed next day. And then I went to a convalescent place at Osborne House, where Queen Victoria died, and another 5 weeks there. And then I went to Taunton to what they call a convalescent depot, where you got fit again. And you went up through a colour system can't quite remember the colours, but you had to get up to, I think you had to get up to the white colour before you could get any leave, and then you were ready to go back to your unit. And it was considered that you would be there 6 weeks. Well, I was quite determined to show that I was fit, and they used to do cross-country running, and I was a very keen cross-country runner. I used to do 15 milers with the Dukes, and I know we went out on one of these runs, and I came first in quite good time. They put me straight on the top colour, and but because I hadn't been there long enough, they then put me in the regimental police in the unit at Taunton. Quite enjoyed that. That was something different.
What sort of job were you doing on that?
Well, just escorting prisoners and taking them for their exercises and things like that.
And from there you went back to your...
I came on leave, and I know I was only given 7 days leave and had to report back to the Isle of Wight. So I sent a letter off to the adjutant, Captain Norley, and asked him for an extension of time because of the travelling. And he sent a telegram giving me 3 days extension and a report to the RTO at Southampton. So in fact it gave me quite a nice extension, really.
So you came back to the unit and recommenced your signal training.
That's right.
Now, how did you come to be drafted away before you'd finished your training?
Well, as I understood it, the 151 Brigade had deserters. This is how I understood it. I mean, whether the facts are right or not, I don't know. You see, they'd come back from North Africa, and now they were told very politely that they were going to be one of the leading divisions in the invasion. And some of them being Geordies, you know, great fellas. I mean, they decided that they weren't going to go. So they had to take the 1st Battalion of the, what remained of the 1st Battalion of the Duke of Cornwall, because as I said, some had gone to Italy, and spread them out amongst the 3 battalions of, in fact, I think Major Northey went to the Hampshire Regiment. I don't think he went to the Durhams.
So the whole of the rest, or what was left of the 1st DCLI, which wasn't really the 1st DCLI, it was the 6th that you said.
That's right.
Was split up amongst
the
division.
Into the 50th Division, I should have thought. but quite a lot of it landed up in the 9th. One or two of the platoon of the 40 of us went to the 8th. But I went to the 9th.
How did you feel about
that?
Oh,
end of the world. I mean, to lose our... being in the Dukes, your cap badge, with the red flash behind the badge, this, you know, was different. And also it was your county regiment. And also the Durhams wore their hats, they wore them straight on the head instead of sideways. They wore them so it looked ridiculous. And it was a catastrophe.
Where were they when you joined them?
Well, at Aldershot where you joined them.
And do you know the month you joined them?
Round about April.
44. So not long before D-Day.
Not long before D-Day.
And how did they make you welcome, if you see what I mean?
Well,
were you able to integrate quickly?
Oh yes. I found that Durham, in fact, that Durham became my battalion. I've got the DCLI badge, tie. I've got the Durham tie. I've never worn the Duke's tie. I've always looked upon the Durhams as my regiment, having fought with them. And they're a fine bunch of chaps. But I think one of the problems was, I can't even remember the company I went into. We were put into a platoon, and very soon put in behind barbed wire, because at that stage we were being shown where we were going to land, although the map was on a very large scale and all the towns were English names. You didn't really know where we were going. But of course all leave had been stopped and we were behind barbed wire.
So you joined them in Aldershot, you put in a platoon. Do you know your platoon officer? His name?
I can't remember his name, and it irritates me because he was a young chap and he was a very nice young chap. And I remember in Normandy, about the third day, we were sat on a hedgerow and we were discussing. He was asking me about my family life and about my girlfriend, and then he talked about his girlfriend. And he was killed on the 14th of June. And I've always regretted I can't remember his name, because I went back to Normandy for the 40th anniversary, or just after. I didn't go. I went with friends. I didn't go as a unit, you know. And I would like to have found his grave, but I couldn't remember. I can't, for the life of me, remember his name.
And what about your company commander? I know you're not sure of your company, but do you know who the...
Well, Major Mov was me.
So we can look that up anyway.
Yeah. I think he was D.
That's all right. Possibly D. And how did you fit in? I mean, you were fed up when you got to Aldershot, to, you know, cap back,
that's
cap,
right.
The rest
that's
of
right.
it.
That's right. That's right.
How did they feel to have a bunch of Cornishmen arrive? Because the Durhams are quite insular sometimes.
Yeah, but I suppose we were kept together. And so we didn't see... Well, the section I went into a section, there was a corporal who had a lot of experience of action.
Remember his name?
No, can't remember his name. He was killed, unfortunately. But he was killed way after I was wounded, I understood. But, no, I can't remember names. I'm terrible on names.
It's all right. So you were saying you were moved into a section.
That's right. And, of course, we were put into a tent behind barbed wire.
Was the barbed wire at Aldershot?
No, this was at Southampton. We moved to Southampton, well, in the Southampton area.
And you don't know the name of the place? It was behind Southampton. It wasn't in Southampton.
Not Southampton. Ramsey would be, somewhere like that, I think.
Nightingale Woods?
Well, no, the wood was in a sort of park. But,
so you were actually, you were literally barbed wire then? There was no way out?
No, and I mean, it was patrolled by your RPs inside, by MPs outside, and then there was another lot of barbed wire which was patrolled by American MPs.
So there was no question of getting out?
No question of getting out.
And what were you doing during the period in the camp, in the Ramsey area?
I remember writing my parents and saying I was having a very comfortable life. Mind your letters were censored. But because you were given a code number, a box number sort of thing. And you, in any case, you wouldn't worry your parents up. My parents had three of us in the forces, so you wouldn't worry them up. But I remember saying that I was having a very comfortable life. We were under canvas but had camp beds instead of lying on the floor. But we were being shown maps and that sort of thing. But it was a very casual month. No real pressures.
How did you feel yourself? Because you'd thought you were too late for active service.
Right, that's right.
And now you... made clear to you were going to get it.
That's right.
And not only get it, but you were actually an assault division.
That's right.
An assault brigade. How did you feel about that yourself?
Well, I felt we were making history. And never thought that I was going to be killed. But I understand that's the general feeling. The general feeling is that it's going to be the other bloke that's going to die. In fact, I read somewhere once that it said that if a soldier didn't think that it was going to be the other one, he'd never go into action. But no, can never think about being killed. We had a very interesting episode there. We had two trucks come through the camp, which contained, they were full of white crosses with the DLI crest on them. And one of my mates, a chap called Poole, dashed over to the truck, climbed up on it. He was a bit of a wag, you know. And he came back and he said, "Boys, it's fine." He said, "Our names are not on any of them." unfortunately, he was killed, and I found his grave when I went back to Normandy and got a photograph of it.
These were the temporary burial crosses.
That's right, just ordinary wooden crosses, which were stuck in temporary things, yeah.
But you were aware, I mean, although you thought you wouldn't be killed yourself, well, you were aware that people who were killed thought that.
I mean, in fairness, you were apprehensive. Wonder what it was going to be like. I think the ones that were more frightened were those who had been in action before. You see, we'd never been in action, so that it was going to be a new experience for us, and we didn't realise really what it was going to be like. I mean, but for those who had been through North Africa and Sicily and Italy.
Some of them had been through Dunkirk as well. I mean, were they showing signs of war weariness?
Well, the corporal was very bomb happy. Very bomb happy.
How did that show?
Well, it reflected on the fact that I felt that he instilled fear into us when we were actually in action.